Well, a great good morning to you on this beautiful fall morning. It's always such an honor when people turn their backs on such a morning and come to the chapel here. It's always good to see you when you do this. As always, we have some announcements. Most of you are already familiar with this, but just in case, we have a food and clothing drive going on to help the less fortunate. It's called Holy Mother's Helping Hands. We're 2 months into this drive in cooperation with the Atlanta Food Bank. The goal is to achieve 500 pounds of food and $1,800 in donations by the end of the year, December 31st. Each week's e-news has details and links for you to be able to make contributions online. Flyers that specify what is needed are in the foyer next to the Atlanta Community Food Bank box. Also, there's a clothes rack on the monastery sun porch where you can bring warm winter clothing, which is intended, of course, for those who are homeless and otherwise disadvantaged at this very cold time of the year. I'm going to take just a moment before going on with the other announcements to ask your prayers and your grace on my home state, which is California. All of you know, I'm sure, that the wildfires there continue to rage, both in the north and in the south. It's become a real health hazard in Northern California especially, even well outside the fire zone itself. So if you can just hold a good thought for those people who are endangered by the fire, who have lost so much, their homes, their belongings. It's a very trying time for people in both North and Southern California. With that said, we're still going to celebrate Thanksgiving Day. We will celebrate Thanksgiving Day next Thursday, of course, November 22nd. From 1:30 to 3:30 p.m., or as long as people want to stay, really. Our potluck feast will be in the monastery's fellowship hall. Your center will offer the day's traditional dishes. Please bring other foods, desserts, and beverages to share. More details on the website and on the Facebook page and in your e-news. On the weekend after Thanksgiving, Swami Atmarupanandaji will visit with us from Friday, November 23rd to Sunday, November 25th. He'll actually be staying with us in the monastery's visiting Swami's room. And on Saturday, well, for those of you who don't know, the Swami he's a very senior American Swami. He's served in San Diego, Vivekananda Retreat Ridgely, as the head of the monastery at Tribuco. He served in India recently as an editor for the new edition of Swami Vivekananda's Complete Works. And then when there was a need, he was transferred and is now living and serving as the resident minister at the Houston, Texas Center. So he'll be visiting with us for that weekend. On Saturday, he'll do a retreat. The morning session is Basic Principles of Karma Yoga, and in the afternoon, Streams of Practice in Karma Yoga. This will be, for those of you who think you know all about Karma Yoga, please come and listen to the Swami. I guarantee you you'll hear something new. On Sunday morning, the Swami will give a truly remarkable talk. The reason I say this is because I've heard an earlier version of it several years ago in Hollywood. The Swami will speak on Prabuddha America, Awakened America. This will be something that you'll be glad to hear, I guarantee you. This will be followed by a potluck lunch and reception for the Swami on that Sunday morning. So the Sunday morning, the 5th? Sunday, November the 25th, we'll have a potluck lunch and reception for the Swami. I'm also very happy to tell you that Swami Sarvadevananda Ji, our head minister of this center, will be with us from Thursday, December 20th to Saturday the 22nd. There will be a program on both Thursday and Friday evenings here in the chapel after Arati, so that will be at 7 p.m., and a special talk on Saturday morning at 11 a.m. When the Swami says it'll be a special talk, he hasn't given me the topic, but you can believe it will be special. On Friday evening, after the Swami's talk here in the chapel, we'll have a potluck supper and reception for him. That will be on December the 21st, Friday. If any of you want to take initiation, mantra diksha, from the Swami, please let me know right away by email. Initiations, there is preparation that needs to be done, some reading and so on. Initiations may be done either on the morning of Friday the 21st or Saturday the 22nd to accommodate your work and personal schedule. So, having made those announcements, is there anything that you know of that I've forgotten to mention in the way of an announcement? Okay, thank you. This morning's topic is giving thanks. Of course, appropriate to the holiday season itself, but especially for Thanksgiving Day. But I'll first give a little preamble about what we study during November. November is a month for the study of Karma Yoga, a spiritual path leading to the abandonment of selfishness. As a karma yogi, you practice offering your actions and their results, as well as your perceptions, thoughts, and feelings, to the divine presence. Even before fully knowing this presence, you hold firmly to the belief that the presence is within each person or other living being that you interact with or serve. Working and abiding in this spirit, you are increasingly able to release attachment to your activities and their results. This yields the freedom and contentment promised by Karma Yoga. As Sri Krishna says in Chapter 2 of the Gita, even a little practice of this yoga will save you from the terrible wheel of rebirth and death. That's again one of Krishna's great promises. The practice of karma yoga, even a little, will save you from the terrible wheel of rebirth and death. So now let's go on to talk about giving thanks. America's beloved holiday of Thanksgiving is just a few days away. We'll talk this morning about giving thanks as a spiritual aspirant. Last Sunday, we ended the talk with this thought. It's paraphrased from Swami Vivekananda's Raja Yoga. It's from the last page of the text of that book. The quote, "The Divine Mother gently takes your self-forgetting soul by the hand, as it were, and shows you all the experiences in the universe, all manifestations, bringing you higher and higher through various bodies, till your lost glory comes back and you remember your own nature." What a statement by Swamiji about what the Divine Mother, the Divine Feminine, is doing. So let's see at the beginning of our holy day season, how we can make a strong connection between Swamiji's promise and an attitude of profound thankfulness. First, some thoughts about the spiritual path from a source that may be unexpected to you. This is from Henry David Thoreau. He's a 19th century American spiritual teacher. He offers us a very practical kind of spirituality. Several quotes from his works have been strung together to make a kind of narrative. So from Henry David Thoreau. Pursue some path, however narrow and crooked, in which you can walk with love and reverence. If you advance confidently in the direction of your dreams and endeavor to live the life which you have imagined, you will meet with a success unexpected in everyday circumstances. As a single footstep will not make a path on the earth, so a single thought will not make a pathway in the mind. As a single footstep will not make a path on the earth, so a single thought will not make a pathway in the mind. To make a deep physical path, we walk again and again. To make a deep mental path, we must think over and over the kind of thoughts we wish to dominate our lives. To make a deep mental path, we must think over and over the kind of thoughts we wish to dominate our lives. What you get by achieving your goals is not as important as what you become by achieving your goals. Things do not change, we change. If you think about what he says here, to make a deep mental path, we must think over and over the kinds of thoughts we wish to dominate our lives. This is precisely the teaching given by Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras in the first chapter, where he says there are various kinds of thought waves in the mind. The thought waves of the mind of untruth or ignorance can be methodically and slowly replaced by thinking over and over higher thoughts, replacing the lower thoughts with the higher thoughts. So you're putting old samskaras to sleep, you're creating new samskaras. This is his assertion. Swami Vivekananda, of course, completely backs it up, as does Swami Prabhupada in his translation and commentary, How to Know God. Of course, we find this same thought in Jnana Yoga, in the recommendation for having heard the truths through Shravana, we do Manana. We repeat these truths over and over to ourselves and compare them with the truths, lower truths, by which we've been living our lives. Slowly and slowly, the higher truths replace the lower truths, and we then arrive at Nididhyasana, which then is a constant and daily, moment-to-moment living of the truth in a form of meditation on the truth or constant recollectedness. So all of these thoughts are familiar to us. And what Thoreau has described to us is a very accurate rendition of karma yoga, the yoga of action, talking about establishing a path, walking that path, repeating the kinds of thoughts over and over that you need to succeed on that path, and then finally changing as a result of walking toward your goal on that path. And as he says, what you get by achieving your goals is not as important as what you become by achieving your goals. Things do not change, we change. So this is karma yoga, the yoga of action. If you hear echoes of Sri Krishna's lessons to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, don't be surprised. Thoreau wrote, "In the morning I bathe my intellect in the stupendous and cosmogonal philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, whose composition years of the gods, since whose composition years of the gods have elapsed, and in comparison with which our modern world and its literature seem puny and trivial. This is what Thoreau thought of the Gita. He wrote this in his book Walden. However, these words, puny and trivial, do not think that they apply to you. You, as spiritual aspirants, all human beings for that matter, are anything but puny and trivial. As Swami Vivekananda said, stand as a rock. You are indestructible. You are the self, the God of the universe. Tattvamasi, that thou art. And as spiritual aspirants, each of you who thoughtfully determines what deserves your attention and then sets your priorities to match what you have determined is walking a path toward spiritual fulfillment. And as you walk that path, you change. It is inevitable. It is inevitable. If you walk that path, you've established what deserves your attention as a spiritual aspirant. You've determined your priorities in your life, the necessary things that you must do take their place. But then the whole frame of reference becomes a spiritual one. As you walk that path, you change. It is inevitable. As you move toward the shining light that you are drawn to in the east, the land of your new life, you automatically leave behind the things of the West, the land of ignorance, stagnation, and death. Now, just putting in the context of giving thanks, is that not a reason for gratitude? It's a tremendous reason for gratitude. Even if your spiritual path has been mapped out in cooperation with a guru, it is still unique because you are unique. As Swami Vivekananda pointed out, we are each of us an infinite dreamer, dreaming finite dreams. You are unique. And as you move ahead, you discover, your spiritual path is, in daily practice, a stand you take. It's a stand you take against the world and its worldliness. It's a stand you take for yourself and the priorities and determinations you've made. So you might verbalize it something like this. I believe thus and so about myself and the world, and we'll talk about some varieties of thus and so in a moment. I believe thus and so about myself and the world. Therefore, I will think, speak, and act from those beliefs every moment as best I can. As Sri Ramakrishna said, let the mind, the lips, and the heart all be one. Speak, act, think in accord. I said we'd talk about the thus and so. I believe thus and so. Say you aspire to be a vigyani, a spiritual seeker who accepts both the world of matter and the realm of spirit as real. In this state of mind, you continuously insist to yourself that no matter how things appear to you in the moment, everything is, in fact, full of consciousness, is Brahman. In time, you may find your life full of bliss. You have become Purna, complete. By repeating that way of thinking, you, as a vijnani, this is the possibility. Your life becomes full of bliss. You are Purna. You are complete. Perhaps you practice as a jnani, someone who takes the stand that God or Brahman alone is real, and the universe of your everyday experience is illusory. Your moment-to-moment watchwords are discrimination or discernment, and renunciation or release, neti neti. Not this, not that. The this and the that do not meet your test of truth, so you let them go. You let them go. These are the actions of a jnani. You gain, therefore, thereby, you gain thereby perfect peace of mind, because you have released all those things that disturb your peace of mind. And so nothing can disturb your yoga. Or you may lead the life, or you may lead the active life of a karma yogi, one who strives to do every action in a spirit of selflessness. You take the stand that everything you are and do belongs to the Divine Presence, as Sri Krishna says in Chapter 3 of the Gita. It's all His. So you take the stand that everything you are and do belongs to the Divine Presence, and so offer all that to the Lord. The results of your actions are then received as gifts, the results, rather than your attaining something. The results of your actions are seen as gifts. You receive them as gifts from the Divine, prasad. And so you have no attachment to those results. Karma yogis often come to think of themselves as just one small, contented wave on the vast ocean of being. And then there are the bhaktas, those whose practice is love and devotion. As a bhakta, you see God or Mother as your master or mistress. You see her as a loving mother, you see him as a loving father or a friend. You take the stand that God is your sustainer, provider, and protector, the life of your life, your all in all. You develop that attitude, that relationship, no matter what the bhava, no matter what attitude, servant, so that you see the Lord as the master, you see the Lord as mother, as Sri Ramakrishna did, and also his master. He said, "This is thy machine, thou art the operator." So you take a stand that God, therefore, is your sustainer, provider, and protector, the life of your life, your all in all. Great reasons for gratitude, as we can imagine. In time, your heart's aching desire to know your beloved intimately is fulfilled. This is the promise of Sri Ramakrishna. In time, your heart's aching desire to know your beloved intimately is fulfilled. You speak with her or with him face to face. So as we can see, whatever your temperament, whatever your spiritual path as designed and mapped out by yourself or by yourself in cooperation with the guru, it's great reason for gratitude. Great reason for gratitude. It frees us. It is a way, each of those paths is a way of freeing ourselves from samsara, from the pain and desperation of life in the world as lived by most. As Thoreau said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. How much gratitude we feel as spiritual aspirants to be freed from that, to have some context, some practice, and a stand we take for something entirely different. So we come come to offering gratitude. We come to giving thanks. It is spontaneous. It seems our love of celebrating gratefully together, as we do on Thanksgiving Day, is built into us. It seems to be part of the fabric of being human. So let's take a look at this grateful Holy Day spirit and what its joyous impulse offers us as seekers of freedom. Let's take a look at this grateful holiday spirit and what its joyous impulse offers us as seekers of freedom and truth. I'm going to quote from some people who we might ordinarily think of as worldly, but they've said things so nicely. Willie Nelson, you may know Willie Nelson. He's a singer-songwriter in the best of the country and Western tradition. And as a service in his life, he has raised millions of dollars to support farmers, especially, and others. And this is what Willie Nelson said. "When I started counting my blessings, my whole life turned around." It turned around from a life of dissolution and to what we typically think of as a country and Western or rock and roll singer. It turned around into a life of glory and service. Before Bill Gates, there was a man named William, I don't know that it's William, it's W. Clement Stone. I think it was William. Anyway, he was a millionaire philanthropist and an author. And he gave away millions and organized many other millions to be given to the worthy causes. And what he said about himself is, if you are really thankful, what do? You share. Now, we all have heard the name Oprah Winfrey, whether we watch her or not. She's a TV personality. But you may not know that she's also a seeker and teacher of spiritual truth. She often attends the temple in Santa Barbara. She has a home in Montecito, not far away at all from the Santa Barbara Temple of the Vedanta Society of Southern California. She goes there. She doesn't make a big deal of it. She goes when other people aren't there. Again, this is a woman who's made millions and given away millions. She is immensely grateful for what her life has become. And she says, be thankful for what you have. You will end up having more. If you concentrate on what you don't have, you will never, ever have enough. And this is such a truth for us to assimilate. It's said in the Christian Gospels, he who will save his life shall lose it. He who will give his life shall save it. In this context, Swami Swahananda once said to me, we are each called upon to be a Christ. That is, to live our life for the benefit of others. So Oprah Winfrey said, be thankful for what you have. You will end up having more. If you concentrate on what you don't have, you will never, ever have enough. And is that not a description of samsara? Is that not a kind of desperation? You will never, ever have enough. You will never be purna. You will never be complete. And finally, you often hear me quote Albert Einstein. I love he was a famous physicist, of course, but he was also a philosopher. Albert Einstein. There are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle. There are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle, the other as though everything is a miracle. As a spiritual aspirant, And even just simply as a human being, our life can be seen as a miracle. Here's a story from the biography of the late Thomas Merton. Merton was a Trappist monk who became a world-renowned spiritual teacher. Though he's been gone for some time now, his books are still bestsellers. On March 18th, 1958, Merton lived at the Gethsemane Monastery, which is near Louisville, Kentucky. On March 18th, 1958, on the corner of 4th and Wall Streets in Louisville, Kentucky, Merton had this vision, quote, "In the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all those people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It is a glorious destiny to be a member of the human race. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun." And I'm going to read that again because I think it really deserves to sink in. This is a vision by a man who was doing spiritual practices for some time, and this was one of the fruits of his spiritual practice. "In the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all those people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It is a glorious destiny to be a member of the human race. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun." And of course, we know from the Upanishads this, that it is a great grace, the first of three graces, to be born as a human being. It is a great manifestation of power to be born as a human being. This is why we are shining like the sun. That power is existing within us. The Atman, or in other terms, that is said in the Upanishads more than one, at the center of our being, at the lotus of our heart, is a little blue being the size of a thumb, whose effulgence is overwhelming, though not blinding. So there's grace to be born as a human being with that Atman, with that little blue being the size of a thumb at the core of our being. That's the first grace. We're talking about gratitude now. What am I grateful for? I'm grateful to be born as a human being. And then, as each of you is manifested by coming here this morning, you have the second grace, which is the grace of yearning to be free. Yearning to be fully alive. To be fully human is to be fully divine. This is what we studied in Swami Ranganathananda's book, Divine Grace. So that second grace is the yearning to be fully divine, to be free of all limitation. And then the third grace, and we've been quoting from some of them this morning, you meet them here, these great swamis, the third grace is the grace of a qualified teacher. We've been quoting from them, you hear from them, when Swami Atmarupananda, when he comes next week, definitely a qualified teacher, someone that you should come and lend an ear to. So those are the three graces. Having come to those three graces and assimilated what they are and their meaning for you, then the fourth grace, and this is not the grace that is given, it is a grace that emerges from your spiritual practice, the grace of your own mind, so that you become your own teacher, you become your own fulfiller of your destiny. So what great reasons to be grateful. What great reasons to be grateful. We are all walking around shining like the sun. So to conclude, here's a Scottish blessing found in the book Celtic Prayers and Blessings. It's a book you can find online. Celtic Prayers and Blessings. This is old. May the blessing of light be on you, light without and light within. May the blessed sunlight shine on you like a great peat fire, so that the stranger and friend may come and warm himself at it. And may light shine out of the two eyes of you like a candle set in the window of a house, bidding the wanderer come in out of the storm. And now may the Lord bless you and bless you kindly. Amen. This business of may the light shine out of the two eyes of you like a candle set in the window of a house, bidding the wanderer to come in out of the storm. This is what happens to spiritual aspirants. As it says in the Chandi, those who take refuge in the mother themselves become a refuge of others. It would be so wonderful if this wasn't allowed on Sunday mornings. I'm sorry. However, there it is. Swami Swahananda said of us as spiritual aspirants, it doesn't so matter what you say. Your life will speak for you. In other words, you don't have to go around evangelizing people. You don't have to go around. Just be your spiritual self, best self, and you become a great grace for others, bidding the wanderer come in out of the storm. And so then the Lord does bless you and bless you kindly. Because not all of you were here at the beginning, I'm going to repeat this announcement. Please note that our Vedanta Center's gathering for Thanksgiving will be held from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. this coming Thursday, November 22nd. The feast will be potluck. Traditional Thanksgiving foods will be provided by the center. Please bring your own family's favorite dish, dessert, or beverage to add to our groaning board. So now comes the best part of this time together. Yes, we have plenty of time. The time that we talk among ourselves. We give ourselves to the congregation by being willing to raise our hand, ask a question, make a comment, so that this group of people encourages and enlivens one another's spirituality. We are a sangha. So please, comments, questions, let's have a conversation. Yes, Ryan.
So I have a question. It's a little off the topic of gratitude, but it occurred to me when you were talking about the Atman. When I'm trying to think of the differences between the concept of a soul and an Atman, is a soul more conceived as a derivative or a belonging of the divine, whereas the Atman is considered the same as the divine?
Precisely. The soul, as we normally speak of it, is roughly equivalent to the subtle body, as conceived of in Sanatana Dharma. The soul is what transmigrates, that is, goes from here to heaven or whatever. That's the subtle body. The essence of our being is the Atman, or this little blue being the size of a thumb, which is, though it seems to be separate, it is anything but separate from all the rest. So yes, the soul is the subtle body, the mind, intellect, and bliss body, that and all of the impressions that go along with them, that travel from incarnation to incarnation, or in the Christian context, goes to hell or goes to heaven. Certainly within Sanatana Dharma, there is no eternity implied by either of those terms, heaven or hell. You experience the fruits of your actions, both the negative actions and the positive actions in between incarnations. And the experiencing of your negative actions, the way in which you have caused others to suffer, may be hellish indeed. Dante describes it very well in the Divine Comedy. But it doesn't last forever. It's a purgation, a learning. And so then you go on to Swarga, where you experience the fruits of your good actions, which normally most of us are much better than we are bad. So that lasts for a longer time, but because we're still entangled with desires, we return to take another body. That's the way we think of it. Uma, would you like to move so you don't have to do that? There's plenty of seats right over here, dear. Anyone else? Yes, Uma. Oh, I thought you... go ahead, Ron.
So I was reading Nandamani Ma the other day, and she was talking so long ago about how the microcosm is part of the macrocosm, but it's also the other way also. The macrocosm is part of the microcosm. And when you were speaking about samsara and how we come back with each incarnation, propelled by our own karmic patterns and desires, I was thinking how interesting it is, because it's another even in our normal life, there is this macrocosm within the microcosm of our life, this principle of suffering the results of our actions. For instance, you do one misdeed and then it just spirals. There are more effects. You just can't do one misdeed and have it be an isolated misdeed. It has continuing reverberations throughout the immediate days and weeks after that. Same as it does on the larger cycle in which we are karmically reincarnated.
I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah.
Anything else? Please.
You were saying something about the Thoreau's comments that things don't change, we change.
Yes.
I mean, that is a little different what the Vedantic teaching.
Is it?
Maybe you could comment on that.
How is it different? Please expand on what you're saying.
When you say things change, it is this universe. It's always a changing universe. But whereas we don't change, that means the Atma doesn't change.
He wasn't talking about the Atman, Balakrishna. He was talking about the spiritual aspirant. As we sit here, can any of us say with any sincerity, I know I am the Atman? That is something that we learn by spiritual practice. We come to that realization through spiritual practice. That is what he meant. Things do not change. The world does not change. It remains, though there's constant change, as the French say, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more it's the same things. The externals of samsara do not change. It's we who change in relationship to samsara, and therefore, by doing the spiritual practices of the various ways that were described earlier, we slowly achieve what is in accord with the bent of our nature, which is, as Sri Krishna says in the Gita, the Atman's creation for its own purposes, and it enjoys that, and therefore validates it. So this is where Thoreau was speaking from. He wasn't speaking about whether the Atman changes. Of course the Atman does not change. And he would have been the first one to say it. Does that answer the question? Okay. Yes?
You just say that the subtle body transmigrates.
This is what we're told, yes.
Yes.
I don't know that of my own knowledge.
Yeah, but then what is liberation?
What is liberation?
Yes.
When you no longer have any, you're no longer entangled with that which causes you to transmigrate. You then achieve independence from all limitations, including the need to take a new body. Sri Krishna describes it nicely in the second chapter of the Gita. And then again in the 18th chapter, he summarizes it. We are liberated when we no longer need any kind of body. This is called, in yoga, kaivalya, independence. Independence of every limitation, every constraint, every need to take form or have name. We point to the subtle body because we can conceive of it having form, mind, intellect, bliss body. We can think of those koshas. So those koshas, those three sheaths, they are what moves from garment to garment, body to body. The energy body and the food body, anamaya kosha, pranamaya kosha, we may take form in some very different circumstance, as Vivekananda describes in Raja Yoga. There are many different forms we may take, not all of them human. So we may have a very different energy body, a very different food body. But those impressions in the mind travel with us. Yes?
Even if I realize that I have Atma inside, but I have to live my life in this present form and do my everyday work, right? Like, I can't always be in that state. That won't suffice the what is needed of me in this present situation,
this is why Sri Ramakrishna recommends for this time the practice of bhakti yoga combined with karma yoga, as is given to us by Swami Vivekananda. We adjust our priorities. We come to some conclusions about what truly deserves our attention. And we leave aside those things that don't deserve our attention and focus on those that do. Now, those things may well be worldly duties. But Sri Ramakrishna says, and he's saying this from a very profound knowledge of the human being and the human psyche, he says that takes only 20%, most, at most, 20% of who you are.
Which one?
The worldly duties, yes. The rest of it, we are able to put our prana and our mental energy into those priorities. So it may seem to us that our worldly life completely absorbs us. So be it. If that's what we believe, then it will be so. If we take the lessons of Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga, Raja Yoga, Jnana Yoga, we see that we have choices, and that our choices have the result of setting different priorities than what we had before we began. And as our priorities change, our life changes because we have changed. So it's easy to surrender. It's easy to surrender to the world and say, there's too much, I can't do it. That's a choice. And it's not as if you're bad and wrong if that's what you do. It's simply, as Adi Shankaracharya said, it is a way of committing slow suicide. You end your life slowly rather than quickly in death and rebirth, rather than attaining the state in which there is no more rebirth, which is the promise of each of the yogas, and for which we must be, in my opinion, immensely grateful that these tools have been given to us. The rishis realized, I can't teach these realizations that I've had the same way to everyone. So these four yogas, these four ways of teaching and being, emerged from their ability to teach. They're very clearly reflected in the Upanishads, and the answers provided in the Upanishads. And so Sri Krishna summarized them in the Gita, and so we find them there as well. Anything else? This is good. Yes, please.
What is the history of Thanksgiving? I don't know much of Christianity.
Oh, it's not a Christian. It's not a Christian holiday.
May I respond?
Yes, please, Mark.
One of the topics I wanted to bring up is that I hope that the historical meaning of Thanksgiving that we all remember to take a moment to honor and remember all the Native Americans,
yes,
the original people of this land, who suffered and were killed, but one of their foundational spiritual beliefs was to give thanks.
Yes, and they did that. They had ceremonies that were practiced at the harvest season, which is certainly not unique. It's done all around the world. It became formalized much later, in the 1930s, actually. It became formalized as the Thanksgiving we know now, which is this big family holiday. People of family gather together, and like-minded people like ourselves, as we'll do here, celebrate, focus on a day of giving thanks for those things that we have reason to be thankful for. Yes, Marla?
The legend that often accompanies this story is that the pilgrims came and they had a long journey. They didn't have the food to survive winter time, and that the Native Americans took pity upon them and gave them a feast to survive, basically, the winter time.
And not
sometimes
only...
it's worked to be the other way around.
Right.
They came and the poor starving Native Americans, and then they gave them a huge feast. And the types of food vary a lot based on the story, but the common foods of Turkey are the native. Turkey, cranberry, those are pumpkins. Those are native foods.
What is available at that time?
Yes, and that those are foods of the New World. The Europeans would not have had pumpkins or turkeys,
from the woods, cranberry from the bush, and the pumpkin they grow.
Yes.
That's it. Sweet potato.
So there's lots of different cuisines associated with Thanksgiving. We have this idea of turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing and so on. But if you go to Maine, they do it very differently. If you go to northwest Minnesota, where it's primarily Norwegians, they do it differently. There's a lot of lefse and lutefisk. Lutefisk and lefse, you know. So, you know, it's, we have this kind of, there was an artist, what was his name? It doesn't matter anyway. He painted a lot of covers for magazines. Norman Rockwell, thank you. Norman Rockwell kind of, he popularized and made kind of as a cultural norm the Thanksgiving feast that we think of reflexively. But it's certainly not that. But the idea, you know, the feasting is wonderful. It's another thing for us to be grateful for. But we come together, we gather together, as we'll see when we gather on the 22nd, we gather in a spiritual context, completely divorced from all the legends and so on about Thanksgiving. This just became formalized as a cultural tradition in this country, as Diwali is in India. We have, you know, but Diwali is not celebrated the same way throughout India.
No, different time.
So but the reason for Thanksgiving is just in the name, to give thanks for who we are, what we are, and the blessings that are been heaped upon us. Everyone in this room is heaped with blessings. Heaped with blessings. Compare yourself, really don't, but I mean, just think for a moment about people in Yemen right now, for example.
Yes.
The people in Yemen. You can even think to yourself those people who lived in Paradise, California. Paradise, California is no more. I knew that town. A dear friend of mine lived there for some time. I visited several times. That town is simply no more. People had to flee with nothing but the clothes on their backs, if they could get out at all. They're still counting corpses. So we have great reason for giving thanks that this is not our lot. Hmm. And so that's the point of Thanksgiving, is giving thanks. Giving thanks for the blessings and for being a spiritual aspirant. We have the tools given to us. And if you want to know what I mean by that, about the tools given to you, come and hear Swami Atmarupananda next Saturday. He will tell you about the tools that Karma Yoga gives you. In the morning, the principles. In the afternoon, the practices. Great tools to free ourselves from samsara. Anything else? Yes, dear.
I don't actually recollect whom you quoted when you said about accepting the results of our actions as gifts. I think when our actions are successful, I find it simple to accept them as gifts and say thanks to the God for making our actions fruitful. But when our actions don't really result in success, at that time I believe most of us would pray to God for a re-evaluation, an opportunity to retry and make it successful rather than accepting it as a gift. And I also read Holy Mother saying that we should be very grateful when we are when we meet with sufferings or difficult circumstances in life. And a lot of, like, William Shakespeare also writes, mm-hmm. treat both success and failure the same.
Yes.
And in Mahabharata it is said that Sati was very grateful to Krishna for giving her all difficult circumstances throughout her life, because she could keep thinking about God and those circumstances. Mm-hmm. And these are things that I find very difficult in everyday life for me.
Yes, this is what is meant, Niranjana dear. This is what is meant by purification.
Yes.
when we do spiritual practices, our attachments, our entanglements become loosened from us. And we see that our desire to create success, as you were saying, and praying to God, oh, let me have a do-over. We may actually pray to God to have a do-over, but not for ourselves, but because that which we wish to accomplish by our efforts, which was a worthy thing to do, has not been achieved. But it's the idea that if you're practicing as a karma yogi, or for that matter as a bhakta, you will see all of your efforts as a gift from the divine. If we just stop and think analytically about the body we inhabit, how little of this is our personal, ego-centered little person doing? Are you making your liver work? No. We think we're making our brain work. Sri Krishna says, ha, you got it all wrong. It's the gunas. You're just observing what's going on there and thinking you're doing it. So these are the thoughts. These are the high thoughts of spiritual practice. Do we know them at this moment? No. We learn slowly and slowly the truths that we are told, that we are not the doer, that we're not even the receiver. The Lord is the doer, and the Lord is the receiver. And when we think that we're the doer and we think that we're receiver, we're only deceiving ourselves. We're abiding in ignorance. But as long as that ignorance prevails, we have to make the best of it. So we do our spiritual practice day to day, moment to moment, dealing with our successes and our setbacks and our sufferings as best we can, keeping in mind exactly what Mother says. All suffering is a blessing. All suffering is a blessing. And in relation to one another, we have the admonition from Swami Prabhavananda. People have a right to their pain and suffering. Do not try to remove it. Sustain and comfort. In other words, be that Vishnu energy, sustaining and comforting, or see it as the mother energy. Sustaining and comforting. We only learn, it seems, by our suffering. So be it. Yes, dear.
Attachment means I'm very attached to my daughter, particularly my friends and my family. But in many contexts, it is said, like, leave. I mean, attachments are also good, right? Like, it gives the sense of belongingness also. Like, I'm born like a human being. So being attached to people who are near me. I like strangers also, like that feeling of belongingness is there. But leaving everything and thinking of, I mean, attachment is also good, isn't it? It's not always...
This idea of leaving everything is a nonsensical way of thinking about how to be unattached. You become unattached by looking at the reality of the situation. Everything about everyone that we are attached to is changing. Constantly changing. We are changing, they are changing. We see our attachments in the context of being temporary. Your beloved daughter, she's a very sweet girl, very talented girl. She's going to grow up, and she's going to become something remarkable, and she will go away. Isn't it so? The nest will become empty. She will become her own human being. And the more we encourage that and support that and sustain that, the better parent we are. All of our friends, in my case, now, at my age, a number of my dear friends are leaving the world in the last 10 years. I can just about count them on my two hands. These are dear friends. So, when we learn the truth of our nature, when we learn that we are that eternal being that lacks for nothing and fears nothing, it's described so clearly and crisply by Sri Krishna in chapter 2 of the Gita. Water does not wet it, sword does not cut it, wind does not dry it. It's not affected by the things, that the temporal changes of the world. When we understand we are that being, then everything else comes into its proper place. When we're operating psychologically and spiritually from that place. This does not mean that even the realized souls do not suffer. The sage Vasishta, who was the great teacher of the incarnation Rama, Vasishta's the Yoga Vasishta, the sutras, the 30,000 shlokas of his 21-day discourse with Rama, are foundational to Advaita Vedanta. Advaita Yoga. When his sons died, Vasishta wept. And Lakshmana said to Rama, Rama, what is this? Here's the sage Vasishta. He taught you all this. He taught you the highest truths. This great sage. He's weeping because his sons died. What's up? And Sri Rama said, my son, my brother, you must understand, he who has knowledge also has ignorance. When we're embodied, ignorance or maya comes with the package. And so when we suffer, when something happens and we suffer, all of that time, space, and causation suit being reacts. Nothing to be ashamed of. He who has knowledge also has ignorance. We only are free from ignorance when we no longer have any need for incarnation, answering Shyam's question. Ignorance ends when the need for incarnation ends. Yes, Uma. You certainly may.
Share some of my observations about the profound wisdom of Krishna's karma philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
On the face of it, if you say, if you hear for the first time, karma ne vadikaraste ma phaleshu kadachin, who in the right mind will like to buy that idea that just work, do not expect the results? So that may shock those people who are growing up in a totally different environment, particularly of these times of cutthroat competition.
Yes.
And dog-eat-dog world.
No, dogs don't eat dogs. We have to stop using that expression. Dogs don't eat dogs.
Never
Exactly.
Ruthlessly against others.
Yes.
So on the face of it, it looks like, huh, what are you talking about? Not expecting. Who will not expect results working hard?
Yes. Not only but do I expect them, I grab them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But what Krishna, in his profound wisdom, is suggesting that instead of expecting feverishly working on that ultimate goal, not ultimate in that sense, but the final result,
mm-hmm.
if you expend your energy on the process of work itself, and if you improve the quality of your work, mm-hmm. karmasu kaushalam, yoga karmasu kaushalam.
Mm-hmm.
So yoga is skill in action.
Mm-hmm.
If you work wholeheartedly and focus on the technique and the skill of your work,
mm-hmm.
you will be competing with nobody else but yourself.
Yes.
So you will be so formidable that you would not have to depend on the results and what, whether I get this or not get this. Because what you said, it is becoming process.
Yes.
And that becoming to me is the most profound idea. That as you work, well, even if it suppose does not show the results, or it do not succeed,
mm-hmm.
even then what it will teach you as you are going through the process of success or failure. So he is pragmatic as well as spiritual, that he prepares you for being ready for not getting success, number one, practically, and second, that psychologically you will be better able to handle it if you don't succeed.
This is what Thoreau was summarizing out of the Gita, as
yes.
he honestly said,
yes.
when he said, achieving your goals is not as important as what you become
exactly.
by achieving your goals.
And another thing I wanted to point it out, talking about your life and becoming, Gandhiji said, when some journalist asked, what is the goal of your life? What is your message? And Gandhiji said, my life, very humbly, not to show off, my life is my message.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
There are so many things in this karma theory, so subtle, yes. such messages.
A really great writer that I knew very personally said, if you want to know me, you will find me in my work.
And Thoreau's statements are ultimate.
Yes.
Thoreau
is. He was a great thinker and teacher. This is wonderful. Anything else? Yes, Sundar.
During the beginning of the discussion, we discussed that Lord Krishna telling that you will be liberated from this cycle of birth and death. So, but in a different context, we tell that God, one, He decided to become many, and I am that.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you take in that context, so you will be liberated from this cycle of birth and death, and then the God telling that I decided to become many. So, doesn't it mean that like every human being, whoever is, so you will be getting liberated only when every human being is getting liberated because I am that?
No. When Brahman or Brahma at the dawn of the day of Brahma says, I am one, I shall become many, then the many began. It's a dream, according to Swami Vivekananda. It is a dream of Brahman. It is Brahman's dream. That's why it's so compelling. That's why it's so convincing. It's Brahman's dream. It's very complete. But he says very clearly, Vivekananda says, and this is, he takes this directly from the Upanishads, especially from the Katha, that when you have attained the state where there are no more vibrations in your mind stuff, no vrittis in the citta, then your universe disappears. You are liberated from the cycle of rebirth and death. You, and Krishna says over and over in the Gita, do it this way, and you won't have to take rebirth. Do it this way, and you won't. So he describes in summary form the four yogas. So each individual facet of the jewel, of this illimitable Brahman, each facet of that need not take name and form. You will take name and form as long as it is the desire of the Atman to promote that. This is what's described so artfully by Swami Ranganathananda in his book Divine Grace. And yes, each one of us, it is said, will attain liberation. But we don't have to wait on all the others. That's why in the Buddhist tradition, one part of the Buddhist tradition, there is something called the Bodhisattva vow. And they, though they have attained the state where they can take liberation, they say, I will not take liberation until all human beings are liberated. All beings are liberated. What a vow. They're saying, I will continue to serve in whatever way the presence gives me to serve, over and over and over again, until all human beings or all beings are liberated. So again, that's embedded in that is the idea that they could take liberation, but they don't. In order to, out of love for humanity, out of love for Buddha consciousness, they wish to share it with the Buddha mind, with everyone. Buddha means awakened. So no, we don't have to wait until everybody's finished. And there's no harm, no foul. We don't have to take the Bodhisattva vow. We can become one with Krishna in any lifetime, and that's fine. You're already dear to him, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
But when you become liberated, you become one with the God. But the God himself becomes a many. So if others are there, then you are also not liberated, right? Like if others are there in the world, as long as the world is there, if God is the world, then where is the concept of liberation?
No. You cannot confuse God and the world. God is the cause of the world, but God is not the world in that sense. You, as the divine being, it's mixing two metaphors, Sundar, to say that you continue to be entrapped until everyone is freed. God is never entrapped. The divine presence is never entrapped. And so when you become one with that divine presence, you become what is referred to by Sri Ramakrishna as an ever-free soul. So God is not entrapped by this, making this creation that is composed not only of goodness, sattva, but also of materialism, tamas, and vanity, rajas. By making this creation, then we have this we have this idea, we have this appearance that we are entrapped. But let me just read again what it is that Swami Vivekananda said. This is so very, very powerful. What it is that is going on here. The Divine Mother gently takes your self-forgetting soul by the hand, as it were, and shows you all the experiences in the universe, all manifestations, bringing you higher and higher through various bodies, till your lost glory comes back and you remember your own nature. This self-forgetting, it's a wonderful pun. You are forgetting yourself, but you are yourself forgetting yourself. So, this is why I jokingly say we're unindicted co-conspirators. Each one of us is participating in this until we aren't. That's the idea. And the way to get to aren't is one of these yogas. That's the way it's taught to us by Vivekananda out of Sri Ramakrishna's teachings to him. There are these four ways that accord with your temperament to ascend higher and higher, never pretending for a moment that you aren't what you are. You are who you are in this very moment. You can say, aham brahmasmi, but can you mean it? Do you know it? No. When you know it, then you will no longer need anything. You will be free of all limitation. So we can talk about the Atman. We can talk about Brahman. We can talk about the little blue being the size of the thumb. All of these things are very inspiring to us. That's why these metaphors are given to us. They're not the reality. The reality is unsayable, unknowable, beyond thought and speech. So they're just ways of thinking about it and organizing our thoughts and our actions so that we move higher and higher pointers. Toward that liberation.
Pointers.
But they're not the reality. The reality is this whole unit, the mind stuff throughout this unit, is not capable by its very nature of holding the infinite. It's finite. By finite, it means perishable. This unit is going to die, dissolve. Until, we're told, enough ignorance has been dispelled for our own glory to come back to us, we will continue to take rebirth. There are some who do it volitionally, those who take something like the Bodhisattva vow. Ramakrishna and his band of minstrels is one example. How great was thy sacrifice, freely choosing thy birth in this prison, our iron age? Why? To unchain us and set us free. This is what is said of Sri Ramakrishna and by extension his associates. They didn't come because they had to. They came because the way it's said in the gospel and in the great master, he asked them to. And why did they come? So that this place could exist. So that we could sit here this morning. So that we could take these thoughts in and make of them what we can until finally we no longer have any ignorance to dispel. And bringing you higher and higher through various bodies till your lost glory comes back and you remember your own nature. But the cause for gratitude is not only this goal that we don't yet know, but the fact that the Divine Mother gently takes our self-forgetting soul by the hand and leads us. This is the reason for gratitude. And, you know, here we sit. Here we sit this morning. Taking all this in, we will make of it what we can. Make of it, and by can, I mean we will develop intentions and priorities and determinations based on this. It seems like we're doing it. And then we read in the Chandi that only Mother is the source of all volition. So is it confusing? Totally confusing. So we say, well, of course, I'm walking in the semi-darkness. I'm thinking I see a snake where there is only a coil of rope. Of course I'm confused. So, at least we're confused here together. At least we have one another to love and care for and support. What a glory that is. How thankful I am for it. I can't even begin to tell you how thankful I am for you and for this place and for this kind of work. So, there we are. Anything else from anyone?
Yeah, please. The answer to the two questions that she has helped me personally, attachment.
Please, please.
I guess the answer is to divinize the worldly duties that we do. Mm-hmm. Everything that we do, offer it as a worship to God.
Mm-hmm.
I watched Swami Sarvapriyananda's video where he had to give a quick speech to a security team at the airport, and he told them, every person that you frisk, think of that person as God. So every moment what you're doing is thinking of God. So the whole day is a worship. You don't have to set aside a time to practice bhakti yoga. You're doing karma yoga and bhakti yoga at the same time. And also attachment, when it is love with expectation, it becomes an attachment and bondage. I love you because you love me, or you give me a sense of importance, then it becomes an attachment or bondage.
Mm-hmm.
But when we just love for the sake of, because we recognize the divinity in someone, or we just love selflessly, that becomes again bhakti yoga. It's like it again becomes a form of worship.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those things...
Beautifully said, dear.
Yeah,
thank you.
That helped me personally, so I just thought we would share.
Yes, and thank you.
It's so beautiful, isn't it? That's what I love. Means I really want to come back. I don't know what I will do with unity to God. I love this thing. There's so many people to be with. It's so nice here. I really like it.
Well, that's
one. I don't want to. I mean,
that's grand. That's grand,
really
dear. That's grand. That's wonderful. If that is the truth of your being, so be it. If we listen to the songs of Mirabai, she lived this at the highest level. She did not want to take liberation, though it was available to her. Krishna would have given it to her at any time. No, no. You keep coming back. I want to keep coming back to love you and worship you and be with you. Now, you can just generalize that. Krishna says he is everything. So if we can see the divine in everything and truly be worshipful in our attitude, as was so nicely said, and, you know, if you want to get a real lesson in this, read Yajnavalkya's speech to Maitreya in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad when she asks him, what you want to give me all this money and your wealth. Yeah. Is it going to do me any good? He says, well, no. Yeah. Well, what will do me good? And then he begins to tell her in very explicit terms. And this is, if you can do this, the bodhisattva vow, this vow to come back, is done out of love, not out of duty. It's out of love for other human beings. Swami Vivekananda, when he left the body, said, I've fallen in love with these human beings. I'm coming back. So there's nothing wrong in coming back. There's something wrong, we might think, in being forced to come back. We don't like to be forced to do things, do we? So, if we're doing it voluntarily, out of love, out of genuine gratitude for human birth, how glorious. That's why I read that from Merton. From Thomas Merton. He saw that. He wouldn't have said it if he hadn't actually seen it. It's very moving. I can't tell everyone, I can't tell people that they're all walking around shining like the sun. It is a great destiny to be born as a human being. Yes, please, Raj.
I just have a simple thought in my mind. The misery is only in the mind, not in your soul at all.
Yes.
And that's what I think.
Exactly. The soul is never limited by anything. The Atman, if we're speaking of the soul. So I can tell by the fact that people are getting up and going that the time is the time has moved along. We can continue this conversation inside. I know for a fact that our beloved benefactor Jim Emerson brought his bag of wonderful things for us to snack on, and so there'll be that and hot water for tea and coffee for anyone who wants it. So shall we wind up here? Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the earth, plants, and trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace. Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere.